Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Coming up, identifying mysterious stones in Cornwall.
How ethnically diverse was Anglo-Saxon society?
And what's the one thing I still haven't found in my career as an archaeologist that I'd give anything to discover?
It's all on this edition of the Time Team podcast.
Welcome to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek. And by now, you should have been able to watch all three episodes of our programme from Norton Disney.
Yeah, and hopefully you really enjoy them. We really enjoyed making them. And it reminds me, Helen, of when we were there. And can you remember, because we had one day, didn't we, to record loads of things whilst that Norton Disney dig was going on. And because, as we discover on a Time Team, and I learned very quickly, it's very difficult to pin anybody down on a dig, especially a three-day, because people are running around like headless chickens and they're all over the place. And so you track somebody down, you say, oh, Danny, you're there, right, stay there. And then you walk off and then Danny's gone or Carenza's gone. And so it took us so long to record our episode that we did whilst filming was going on that, do you remember we were interviewing Carenza in the dark?
Oh, we were. I had forgotten about that. I do remember you just not realising how difficult it was going to be because there was just no way of finding anybody unless you knew every single place they could be. So even if we had a radio and said, has anybody got eyes on Naomi or something? They'd say, yeah, she's around the back of the manor house or something. And you'd think, whoa, what does that mean? Where's the back of it? Where's the front of it? Where's the manor house anyway? And or Test Pit 23. And you think, oh, well, I know where number 7 is, but where's number 23? It was a learning curve for me thinking, gosh, Martin, so far you don't know how chaotic a Time Team can be. And
well,
it's all
I soon
smoothed out.
Learnt how chaotic it can be. I remember it being a really, really good episode, but I just remember that it was absolute chaos and that it was because there's no lights, or there were no electric lights in the dome because it was only being used during the day. And we were there and it was probably about 7 o'clock at night and we were trying to record our last interview and we could barely see our hand in front of our face.
And the more worried, the more you think, I've got to get this finished, the less relaxed you are and the worse you are at doing the job. So you just, it gets to a point where you just have to say, let's stop. This is ridiculous. We're not getting anything done.
I know. But anyway, we did get something done and we did get an episode that we recorded on site at Norton Disney whilst recording was taking place. And that is really interesting, actually. And we didn't have all the facts that you will now have if you've watched all three episodes, because there's a lot of work that goes on post-dig to give you the full picture. But it's quite a good episode to go back and listen to if you haven't already done so, because it shows us at that snapshot in time, at that moment whilst the dig was going on. It's really easy to find, by the way. If you go back, it's literally the only one that's called Norton Disney. So go back and have a listen to that one and you will find it there. Welcome along to this episode, though, which is all about your questions and Helen providing answers to them. Thank you so, so much if you've got in touch via Patreon. Our Time Team members are there in the special little chat section, the community chat section, suggesting questions for Helen. And let's crack straight on with them, I think, if that's all right, Helen. I know you've got a Helen's Find to come in just a little bit as well, but let's start with question number one, which comes from Michael. This is Michael Sperry, who says, we've seen many examples of cultural transmission from Europe to the British Isles. And we talk about this a lot, don't we, with pottery and textiles and metalworking. But are there any noteworthy examples of the reverse? So I guess this is stuff turning up in Europe that would have come from Britain. Has anyone, says Michael, dug up an obviously British pottery shard in a Roman site in Europe somewhere? There had to be some back and forth exchanges. And that makes sense, right? Because trade would have been going on quite a lot, I'm imagining, between the continent and us in Britain. So you would expect to find some British stuff in Europe.
Yes, you would. You would, absolutely. And I think that's a really important thing to say, because there is a kind of pervasive tendency to feel that we're in Britain some kind of passive receiver of waves of civilization that kind of come from the Mediterranean, which is of course clearly the center of everything. But there are a lot of hints that we may not just be this cultural backwater that's waiting for the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians and the North Africans and so on to come and civilize. But unfortunately, you have to be a very good expert in a lot of these fields to know what it is. So I think that there are probably some really good examples from prehistory that I don't know anything about. So I can only give an early Anglo-Saxon perspective. But as you go through studying Anglo-Saxon objects, you find occasional examples of really unusual and interesting stray finds. Like one of the best known is that there's a great square-headed brooch from Geneva in Switzerland, but it's not the normal kind because it's made from lead. I mean, it's just like any other great square-headed brooch, but made from lead. Does that suggest that it might have been used to manufacture a normal copper alloy brooch? Well, yeah, it could have been. But A, it's very weird to find it in Geneva. And B, if it's something to do with the making, then obviously they're not making these things in Geneva. How has that worked its way there? Was it something that was used and or maybe not used and somebody gave it to someone as something not terribly useful? I mean, you have to look at individual personal explanations there, and that can get quite difficult. So one-offs are not that useful. But there are a few patterns as well. Now, lots of people know about the Frankish influence that you see in Kent and the Isle of Wight in the 6th century and in Anglo-Saxon cemeteries. But there's also a group of cemeteries in France, particularly in northern France, that look just like cemeteries in Kent or the Isle of Wight. And they seem to be communities of Anglo-Saxons living there, which I can see isn't quite cultural transmission, but it is influence that could have come over. Now, the most famous one is called Erp. I mean, I do apologise for my pronunciation there. Often it's called Erp Charente, because the word Erp is completely impossible to hear. And so Charente kind of gives you a bit of an extra chance of understanding what it is. And that's actually quite a long way south. That's in the kind of Bordeaux area. In fact, looking it up on the map, I see that it is even closer to Cognac. So I was wondering if we should try to, you know, get some kind of research trip going
there. Lovely.
But the objects from Erp, they were collected, I think, in the 19th century, and then the collection was sold and they made their way into museums across Europe. So the British Museum's got a big collection of Erp objects, and that's why we know so much about them, perhaps. They look like objects from a normal Anglo-Saxon cemetery. So what's going on? What is this community doing there? And it has been suggested, unsurprisingly, that those sites might have been, particularly Erp, it might be have been to do with the wine trade. Now, that's quite logical until you think, well, do we have any evidence for the wine trade in Britain in late 5th or 6th century England? I mean, you'd expect pottery containers, wouldn't you? Although, as I was musing on this earlier on today, I suddenly thought, well, what about a wine skin? Could you transport wine in some way that wouldn't leave any archaeological trace? That then led me on to this problem of the archaeological traces. People often ask what was traded from Britain to the continent in return for things like possibly the wine, certainly the garnets, the amethysts, the cowrie shells, the elephant ivory. You know, what's being swapped? And what people tend to say, they always use these things that don't leave much archaeological trace. Some of them we've got historical evidence for. Over and over again, from Julius Caesar up to the Norman conquest, we're told that Britain's exports are hunting dogs, wool, cloaks, and slaves, none of which, until now, have left any archaeological evidence. Now, the slaves, the human remains, does give us a chance that one day we might be able to find a DNA signature or an isotopic signature that would allow us to identify them. There's also tin ingots from Cornwall. You know, there's not many other places in Europe that have tin. But again, that's all very hypothetical, and leaving aside these Anglo-Saxon cemeteries in France, the only really solid evidence that I know of is these incredibly tantalising finds of Anglo-Saxon glass beads that come from sites in East Africa. There's some in Tanzania, there's some in the Sudan, and apparently those are securely stratified in good early medieval contexts. There doesn't seem to be a great deal of knowledge in Britain about these things, and I wonder if, you know, more work is always what we say. More work done in Africa is not particularly easy. Archaeology is a luxury in those countries, but they do suggest that Britain is sending out influence and objects and so on in the early medieval period, so it probably should be in other periods as well.
And do you think that those objects, the artifacts, we know we're not talking about the dogs and the slaves and things like that, but the object, would they have been identifiably British to people who were there? You know how you can maybe tell if you get a Swiss Army knife or something, you go, ah, well, that's a product of Switzerland. Or if you buy a certain type of car, you know it's a German car or a French car, yeah, or whatever. Would it have been noticeably British in production?
Well, that's one of the difficult things. And what I'm conscious that I'm not really answering Michael's question, because he's thinking about cultural transmission, whereas I'm talking about a few things that might have been traded. I don't know whether they would have been obviously British or obviously Anglo-Saxon or obviously Cornish or Welsh or whatever like that. I also don't know of any examples where they have really added something to the culture of the area where they've ended up. When we have examples of things like Byzantine influence coming over to England, you can see it filtering out into English-made products and so on. You can see, I mean, a bit like your analogy of the Swiss Army knife, you can see kind of fake Swiss Army knives that are made here and they're not quite so good as the original one from Switzerland. I don't know very much along those lines, but the trouble is that I am an intensely English archaeologist, and my knowledge of what's going on in Europe, my knowledge of what's going on further afield, say Russia and the Caucasus and North Africa and so on, is even worse. Take me further away, take me down to Tanzania, and I know literally nothing. This is a question that needs a different expert, or possibly a conference.
Or a collaboration between you knowing what all the British and the English stuff looks like, and then somebody who maybe is an expert on their particular area to be able to identify the local artifacts. Yeah. Well, you've got us thinking now, Michael, about who we could speak to that would maybe be able to help answer your question even more than Helen has done. But very interesting. Thank you very much for it. Let's move on to question number two. Now, question number two, Helen, and we're going to do this just before Helen's find, by the way, which is an artifact, an object that Helen is going to bring to your attention. But this is something that Katie Hebbs, is bringing to your attention. And there is a photo with this, which I appreciate that if you're just listening to this podcast, you can't see this photo, but we will try and describe the photo that we are looking at. And it's quite intriguing. Now, Katie says, I recently went to Cornwall, lucky thing, and would love to know more about Carn Uni and how they used these stones that were in the houses. Now, these stones are this photo of a stone that's in the ground. It's sort of like a, I don't know, that like you might put on a roadway, as in it's flat to the ground, but it's got this little recess in it, a little dip that's maybe, I'm guessing, can't quite tell the scale, but maybe the sort of size of a football.
Oh, that's like a, isn't that fascinating? Like a, because you say a football.
Yeah, well, you're not saying a football. I think it looks like a sort of a dip where you could imagine that a football would fit.
Well, this just shows the problem of not having a scale. I was thinking a tennis ball. And you may, Martin, you may have seen a slightly more blown up picture. I don't know. I wonder if we blew it up, we might see that there were some plants that we could use as a scale, but it really does highlight how important it is to have a scale. Now, Katie's photograph is extremely neat. She has taken the trouble not to put her foot in the photograph, for instance. But if you had put your foot in the photograph, we would have known how big it was. That's a useful learning experience. Always put someone or something.
Yeah, like a pound coin or something you could have put in there to give us an idea. Mm.
Or your finger pointing towards it. But yes, I thought it was about the size of a tennis ball. And that's possibly because I had already decided what I thought it was. Now, this to me looks like a kind of rough cobble with a with this kind of hemispherical depression in it. And I thought that it wasn't big enough to have been used as a mortar or a grinding hollow with a pestle to grind up something like, well, mustard over here in East Anglia, or maybe saffron over there in Cornwall, or anything small and important, probably a spice or something to make a recipe, like for a glue or something. Now, I didn't think it was big enough for that, but if it is football size, maybe it was. I also thought it was too deep to have been caused by, if you're trying to polish something like a stone axe, you don't want it too deep because you've got to be able to get your thing that you're polishing in it. So I thought that maybe it might have been used as a base for a wooden gatepost or a door hinge, because one of the problems with opening a door is you can hang it onto iron hinges once you've got iron, but if you are a poor community and you don't have iron, or you're a pre-iron community, you've generally got a kind of wooden post on which the door is fixed, and you need to be able to rotate it. And something like this stone, you could make a little depression in it, which would help to begin with. And over time, it wears itself down to quite a good socket. And you can have a big one for a gatepost, but a relatively small one, like about the size of a tennis ball, for a door hinge. So that may have been what made me think it was a bit smaller than you thought, Martin. But I think this leads us on to a kind of bigger lesson. You know, all of these questions are giving us useful lessons today. The useful lesson is that this is just a guess that's based on absolutely no knowledge on either of our parts. It's a hypothesis, if you like, but it would need to be tested on the evidence. So maybe it could have been used as a door hinge, but that doesn't mean that it was used as a door hinge, because as I always say, common sense is a really bad guide to the past. Human beings are not as full of common sense as we like to think they are.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Okay, time for Helen's Find now, which is the bit of the podcast where the questions stop for a moment and the floor is turned over to Helen and an object that she has come across that she wants to talk about. Now, as you know, of course, Helen is a finds liaison officer, so constantly things are coming across your desk, Helen, of interest, of archaeological interest. So what have you brought to the table this week?
Well, I thought that we do spend a lot of our time, well, particularly me, in the early Anglo-Saxon world, we talk a lot about brooches because that's the normal way in which clothes are fastened from the Iron Age to the medieval period. That's how you get in and out of your clothes. Now, buckles are invented by the Romans and they're used for straps. So buckle is related to the Latin for cheek, and they were originally used to fasten the cheek straps of a helmet. So they're used for straps. Pins are used a bit, especially for headgear like veils. But apart from that, those two, it's really brooches all the way up to about 1500. And after that, it's mainly buttons and lacing of the garments. And then, of course, in the 20th century, we get zips coming in and Velcro and so on and so forth. But for a really large chunk of human history, it's been brooches. So who invented the brooch? And a related question is, what did they use before? You know, because there's always these interesting questions of something that seems quite obvious, that's invented quite late in human history, even though you'd think that there would be the need for it. So let's look at the earliest brooch that we've got recorded on the Portable Antiquities Scheme, the earliest type of brooch, and we might think a bit about what was used before. So the object is an Iron Age brooch which was found in Whittlesford in Cambridgeshire earlier this year. And you've got the number and the link, Martin, so you can open it up and have a look at it.
If you go to the description of this podcast, you will be able to click the link to the Portable Antiquity Scheme, which is where you'll see it. And what you'll see is, well, to me, that just looks like coils of of wire.
Yeah.
But, you know, quite thick metal wire, but coiled up.
Yes. And, you know, hats off to the detectorist who discovered it and to my colleague in Essex, Laurie, who recorded it. It's not an easy object. And you do wonder if things like this have been found in the past and people just didn't notice the... didn't know what they were looking at and so threw it away as a modern piece of wire. But what's really great about this record is that it's one of the very few portable antiquities scheme database records to have a 3D scan. So you can manipulate it and you can turn it round. It's not just a tangle. Once you can turn it round in 3D, you can see where the wire is going. It's very like a safety pin. It's got a catch at one end and a spring at the other. And in between, it's got that very high hump to give space for the fabric of the clothes. And it's all made from a single piece of wire. It runs upwards from the catch, making the bow, making the hump, and then up to the spring. It turns a couple of coils to form one side of the spring. Now, those coils form a spiral of quite large size. If you follow them round, you can see that those loops, those coils, are on one side of the body of the brooch, and then the wire is taken on an arch over them and then wound round to make the coils on the other side. And then it turns into the pin, which runs down to the catch to make the loop of the safety pin. Now, that arch that goes over the top of the spring, that's a crucial diagnostic feature. And it's known for some reason as the cord of the spring. I don't know why. And it goes outside the loop of the brooch when it's closed. So that's called an external cord. And that's absolutely diagnostic for an Iron Age brooch. At the end of the Iron Age, that cord shifts to running underneath, inside the loop of the spring. So that gives you a kind of guided tour of the object. There's very little decoration. It just basically is a piece of wire. Those brooches are first made in the 400s BC. So it's the middle of the Iron Age. There have been suggestions that they might start earlier because I think people find it really difficult to imagine how you would keep your clothes together without brooches. Presumably they're using pins, because we have quite a lot of Bronze Age pins. But why did it take so long for somebody to think it would be quite useful to bend our pin so that it was, A, less likely to fall out of our clothing, and B, a bit safer? You weren't going to, if you picked up a child, you weren't going to jab them in the arm with it. They must have been quite dangerous things. I mean, everybody with small children knows that you don't wear earrings, you don't wear anything when you pick them up that they can grab at and damage themselves or you. At the British Museum, the Iron Age curator, Sophie Adams, she did a PhD on them about 10 years ago, and she absolutely nailed down the dates. She said anything that appears before that is either an import or it seems to be copying a European brooch. So that harks back to our chat earlier about relationships between Britain and Europe. So we're left with the idea that we have brooches on the continent. It takes us a while in Britain to copy them. We don't seem to have had this idea, but we've been wearing clothes since, well, clothes, as I think we've talked about before. There's evidence for humans of some sort wearing clothing of some sort since before Homo sapiens. So how was it all held together in the days before textiles? How was it all held together in the days of animal skins? Was it all ties and holes, and you slip a scrap of hide through a hole that you've cut somewhere else and you tie a knot? Well, that's not very secure. Was it all wooden toggles? Is it, I've heard ideas that it might have been a thorn originally holding things together. None of these seem like common sense, you know, and I'm always saying common sense is a really bad guide to the past.
You just said don't use common sense.
I know, I know. Don't use common sense. So, but you can use common sense to line up your hypothesis. You then have to go and test it. So I would like to know more about how clothes are held together before brooches, but I do accept that it may be something that it's very difficult to find evidence for.
It's a good thing to get you thinking. If you want to go and have a little look as well, you can do that right now. Just click on the link in the description of this podcast, which takes you to the relevant page on the Portable Antiquities Scheme.
This is the Time Team podcast where I'm this week answering your questions.
Yes, and this one has come in from Chris, who said, just read an article about Anglo-Saxon burials where two individuals have ancestry from sub-Sahara. I read this one as well, and it was very, very intriguing. The girl buried around 650 CE had a grandfather whose DNA would match people living in what is now Nigeria. That seems to be too late that he could be a Roman soldier. Is there any idea what a trade route from there could have looked like in Anglo-Saxon times? So I suppose the question can also be, how ethnically diverse would Anglo-Saxon society have been, especially if we have people who were buried in burials with everybody else? So this is not, I don't think, from what I remember reading of the article, this is not a sort of slave thing. They were buried alongside other people from the community. So would have been, we think, perhaps treated in the same way and would have been part of that community. How ethnically diverse would those societies have been?
Yes. Now, we all tend to think that in the days of the Roman Empire, there's a lot of diversity, that people are moving around a lot on the lovely Roman roads with the marvellous hobnailed sandals and horses and things. And we can see these mechanisms by which people move around. And we can also see from tombstone evidence that they really did. So there are people from Syria that we know about, from Northumberland and so on and so forth. And then we tend to feel that the shutters come down somewhat, don't we? At the end of the Roman Empire, we get the big invasion of the Anglo-Saxons, and then everyone just sits being English until the Norman conquest, or maybe if you're in the right place, you get a bit of the Vikings. That, I think, is because we don't have the evidence to show that they were travelling. So we don't have the tombstones. We have very homogeneous grave goods suites that don't look like people were arriving from all over the place and being buried differently. But don't forget that you don't bury yourself. Your community, your family buries you, and it may not reflect where you were born or where you grew up or even what you think of yourself. It reflects much more what your community and your family think of you and themselves. One little bit of evidence that we have got is, of course, what Helen Gittos has managed to squeeze out of the Byzantine sources, that suggests that the Byzantine army, so we're now looking into the late 6th and early 7th century, the Byzantine army was gathering recruits from all over Europe and North Africa, in the same way that the Roman army gathered its auxiliaries from outside the empire, and its auxiliary troops were again quite diverse in terms of their origins. So I think that this is what we need to look at. You could imagine somebody who's born and grew up in West Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, who's the kind of person that likes to go travelling. And they might find themselves moving up to, say, the Mediterranean coast, where they hear that the Byzantine army is looking for soldiers. And they think, well, that sounds like fun. That would enlarge my horizons. So off they go to Byzantium, where they meet all sorts of other people who've come from all over Europe and Western Asia. And they fight in the wars against the Sasanians. And then when those wars come to an end, what do? Do they go home? Or does one of their friends say, hey, you could come to this wet island with me that's on the edge of the world? And they think, gosh, how could anything be more exciting? And so they come and settle in Dorset. You know, it might not be exciting.
And then they turn up in Tewkesbury.
Yes, it might not be exciting to us. But if you've grown up in sub-Saharan Africa, maybe England is just as exciting as Timbuktu is to us. I don't know. I'm seeing really more personal stories here that it would be very difficult to check, because at the moment we haven't got a pattern. We've got two individuals, and we just need to do an awful lot more DNA analysis until we know how diverse the origins of the people in our cemeteries are. I'm not wanting to say ethnically diverse, partly because I don't really believe in human beings are just so, there's so little genetic variability among humans that I don't think we have anything like ethnicities or races or whatever. I just think that doesn't make any sense when you look at the science. I think it's more a diversity of appearance and origin. We don't really know at the moment what their appearance would have been, but we do know that they all seem to be considered Anglo-Saxon. So this girl whose grandfather was sub-Saharan, from sub-Saharan Africa. Maybe her hair looked different. Maybe her skin looked different. But she was an Anglo-Saxon. She was buried as an Anglo-Saxon in an Anglo-Saxon cemetery. So in a way, to me, it doesn't really matter where you're born or what your descent line is. If your community thinks you're an Anglo-Saxon, if you're buried as one, then you are one, aren't you?
Yeah, she was accepted by the community, wasn't she, as one of them?
Yeah, she wasn't seen as anything different.
So therefore she is.
So
yeah.
Ethnically, she was Anglo-Saxon, whatever that means, whatever ethnically means. Her descent may have included other people, but her descent also included Anglo-Saxon people. So why prioritise one over another?
Okay, let's do the final question now, shall we? And it comes from Gary. Gary Matthews. Hello, Gary, who says, given Helen's experience and many digs under her belt, what is the one thing or place that is her top priority to find? So I'm guessing this is the, you know, of all the things that you've seen and found and places you've been and that sort of thing, what's the thing or the place or the artifact or whatever it might be that you'd love to scrape your trowel over that you haven't quite yet managed to do?
Well, that is a good question. I think one of the things that would be absolutely spectacular to find is a comparative site to Sutton Hoo for another kingdom. And that is really what I began doing my PhD searching for. But so few candidates have been found for royal burials in the other main kingdoms. I mean, we've got Prittlewell for Essex possibly, and maybe Taplow, but they all seem to be a slight grade lower than Sutton Hoo Mound 1. And of course, the most interesting one would be one from a kingdom that stays pagan for longer. And when it comes down to it, really, the burial place of Penda of Mercia, I mean, wouldn't that be astonishing? Wouldn't that be wonderful to be involved with? That just seems like the best thing ever. But the other thing, though, that is a will-o'-the-wisp that I'm always chasing after is their lost objects. So the Witham Hanging Bowl is one of the most famous of these. And I learned about that at university. And if I was ever having trouble dropping off to sleep at university, I would play this little fantasy of cycling past a junk shop and seeing the Witham Hanging Bowl in the window and going in and casually saying, oh, that's an interesting bowl you've got there, and seeing how much they would sell it for. But let me tell you all about the Witham Hanging Bowl. It was discovered in 1816 in Lincolnshire. It was last seen in 1868. But in between those two times, at some point, it was really beautifully recorded with these very detailed drawings commissioned by the Society of Antiquaries. But then, extraordinarily, even the drawings were lost.
Oh.
And they were rediscovered in 1941. And at that point, they were published and people said, well, how can this have just disappeared? Where is it? Let's have an appeal. It's never, ever come to light. And these drawings show this really small bowl. It's about 6 inches across, made of silver. So obviously it does have a certain intrinsic value. I mean, one would hope it hasn't been melted down for the silver. That would be absolutely crazy. It's got 4 animal head hooks from which you could suspend it on a chain. And the most extraordinary thing about it is that it's got this three-dimensional figure in the middle. It looks a bit like a giraffe and it's standing up, you know, with a long neck. It looks a tiny bit like the Sutton Hoo Hanging Bowl that's got a fish on a pedestal that's kind of swimming in the middle of it. But it dates to the 8th century, and that's what makes it another extraordinarily tantalising thing, that very little of what we have in terms of great objects can be dated securely to the 8th century. It's a very mysterious time. So every so often, there's another appeal for it. You know, look through your old trunks, look through the attic. It can't possibly just have got lost. The last recorded person who had it was an MP, and I imagine that his descendants have all looked very thoroughly. We just don't know what happened to it, and it's so bizarre.
That's very strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
And were it to be discovered, I mean, how big of a thing would that be?
It would be massive. It would be pretty much as big as the Sutton Hoo helmet. You know, that this object is a landmark. We have these incredibly important objects that make kind of stepping stones across the years, like the Bayeux tapestry and the Fuller brooch, and they go, I'm going backwards now in time, and right back to the Sutton Hoo helmet and the Staffordshire Moorlands pan and the the Elgin marbles, you know, the Parthenon marbles, the kind of iconic things that stand as representatives of a generation of craftspeople. And I think the Witham Hanging Bowl, you know, it's got filigree, it's got millefiori, it's got three-dimensional modelling, it's got everything in that tiny little space. It's so, the detail is so extraordinary. The Ardagh Chalice, for instance, that's another one. It would be up there with them. And how can we have lost it so completely?
What a mystery. I think somebody needs to make a documentary. Mm. There's probably already a load of documentaries, but somebody needs to make another documentary about this. An investigation needs to be launched immediately. Very good. So that's the thing that you'd like to come across. Is there a place that you'd like to discover or sort of dig that you haven't had the chance to?
You mean something that I know exists and needs to be excavated, but nobody's managed to do it yet? Well, I'm sorry that I'm always banging the same drum, but, you know, I am so interested in our knowledge of power in the 7th century among the Anglo-Saxons. Now, there's a barrow called Benty Grange in Derbyshire, which was excavated and has produced the only other helmet that was known from the Anglo-Saxon world for decades and decades and decades. There was just the Benty Grange and the Sutton Hoo helmet at one time. And it's incredible. It's got a boar on the top of it. So it is one of those boar-crested helmets that we know about from Beowulf and that we see pictures of on the Sutton Hoo helmet. It actually has a little boar on the top of it, made of iron and gold and garnet, and with a little hairy crest along the top that has is reconstructed to have been made from horsehair. That barrow has never been re-excavated. And given how much more we can get out of those sites now, I would absolutely love to be able to do something about that. It's also, because it's in Derbyshire, it's quite a peripheral area to the Anglo-Saxon world. It's thought possibly that the Derbyshire area has got, well, it does have lots and lots of very rich burials that most people don't know about. And it's thought that this might be because of the lead mines. And as soon as churches start getting built, there's a big demand for lead to build in the Roman manner. You don't need lead to build a wooden house, but you do need lead to build a stone building. So the hypothesis is that we have lead from Derbyshire, which is transferred to the rest of Anglo-Saxon England, and in return they get a lot of recompense, which allows them to have gold and garnet necklaces and helmets and so on and so forth. It's a really understudied area. It could really do with so much more being known about it. And Benty Grange has never been accessible to archaeologists. And so that's the one that I'd like to go for.
That's great. I think we need to try and wangle some way of doing a dig there at some point. Let's talk to the people and make it happen. Gary, great question. Thank you very much indeed. That is pretty much all we have time for this episode of the Time Team podcast. Thank you so, so much for getting involved. We will be back very soon with lots more, some exciting stuff to bring you next week. I shall not say any more about it at the moment. You're just going to have to listen. It is going to be well worth listening and indeed watching, of course, because our next episode will also be available to watch on YouTube.
Yes, thank you so much for listening. It's been a pleasure to have your company, and thank you so much for sending in so many lovely questions. I look forward to the next batch. And until then, thank you very much for listening to the Time Team podcast. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.